Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey everyone, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The podcast you're about to listen to contains a Class 4 information hazard. Some listeners may experience prolonged bouts of fear, waking anxiety, or nightmares of eternal torture in the cyber dungeons of the Great Basilisk, attended to by the Peelers in Black and the 13 Children of the Flame. Also, appetite loss and constipation. Proceed with caution.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And since it's October, we are, of course, still exploring monsters, terrifying ideas, and so forth. And boy, have we got one for you today. I just want to issue a warning right at the beginning here. Mm-hmm. That today's episode is going to concern something that a few people would consider a genuine information hazard, as in an idea that is itself actually dangerous. Now, having looked into it, I don't think that is the case. I don't think this episode will hurt you. But just a warning, if you think you're susceptible to terror or nightmares or something when presented with a thought experiment or the possibility of being, say, sent to a literal hell created by technology, and you think that idea could infect you, could make you afraid, this might not be the episode for you.
Right. But then again, I assume you're a listener to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. You've probably already encountered some thought hazards on here. You've survived those. Generally speaking, I have faith in you to survive this one. However, if you are going to take either of our warnings seriously, I will let you know that the first section of this podcast is going to deal with the mythical basilisk, the folkloric basilisk, and some of the monstrous fun to be had there before we explore the idea of Rocco's basilisk. And in that, we are going to be talking about this idea that emerges where technological singularity, navel-gazing, thought experimentation, a little dash of creepypasta, and some good old-fashioned supernatural thinking all converge into this kind of nightmare scenario.
Now, as we said, this idea is believed by some to be a genuinely dangerous idea, and that even learning about it could put you at some kind of risk. I think there are strong reasons to believe that this is not the case and that thinking about this idea will not put you at risk. But again, if you're concerned, you should stop listening now, or stop listening after we stop talking about the mythical basilisk.
Right.
Now, I just want to say at the beginning, listeners have suggested us talk about Rocco's basilisk before, this idea that is at least purportedly an information hazard, a dangerous idea. And I've hesitated to do it before, not because I think it's particularly plausible, but just because, you know, I wonder what is the level of risk that you should tolerate when propagating an idea. If you think an idea is unlikely but maybe has a 0.00001% chance of causing enormous harm to the person you tell it to, should you say the idea or not?
I don't know. I feel like people generally don't exercise that kind of caution when they're like sharing links with you. Like sometimes they'll be like not safe for work, but but then you click on it anyway, and then sometimes you're like, oh, well, I wish I had not seen that, or I wish I had not read that, and now that's in my head. Now that's in my head forever.
Well, one of the problems with this idea is whatever you think about whether or not you should discuss ideas that may be dangerous to hear in some extremely unlikely off chance, part of the problem is what happens when those ideas are just already set loose in society. I mean, now people on television shows and all over the internet are talking about this idea. There are a bunch of articles out about it. So it's not like you can keep the cat in the bag at this point.
Right. This Rocco's basilisk has already been a gag point on the hit HBO show Silicon Valley, which is a fabulous show. And I love the way that they treated Rocco's basilisk on it. But yeah, if they're covering it, there's no danger in us covering it too. That's the way I look at it.
Right. And at least I would hope that the way we cover it can give you some reasons to think you should not be afraid of digital hell, and also to think about the general class of what should be done about something that could have in fact been a real information hazard in some other case. So that's all our whole preamble for before we get to that section. But before we get to that section, we're going to be talking about basilisks today. Boy, is the basilisk a great monster.
Yes, also known as the basilcock, the basilcock, the basilicock. Basically, any version of that, of basil and cock that you can put together, that you can slam together, then it has been referred to as such at some point in its history.
Now, a lot of people, I think, probably encountered a version of the basilisk from Harry Potter. But Robert, I know that was not your entryway.
Right. I encountered it for the first time, I believe, in Dungeons & Dragons.
Of course.
Because it's a multi-legged reptile with a petrifying gaze.
Say that again?
A multi-legged reptile with a petrifying gaze.
Petrifying gaze.
Yeah,
so
its gaze
will
turn you to stone. Yeah. And if I recall correctly, it has some cool biology where like it turns you to stone and then like busts you into pieces. Then it eats the stone pieces, but then its stomach turns the stone back into flesh. And so if you get like the stomach juices from a basilisk, then you can use it to undo petrification spells, that sort of thing. It's a lot of fun, arguably more fun than the basilisk is at times in folklore and tradition, because one of the things is if you like me, you didn't grow up hearing about the basilisk, part of it is because there aren't really any great stories about the basilisk. Slaying the basilisk was no hero's great ordeal.
Oh, yeah. I at least have not come across that.
Yeah. It really helps. Like the Hydra. I mean, the Hydra is arguably so much cooler. And then also it's one of the labors of Hercules. And there's a cool story about how they defeat it.
Well, maybe it's because there is no way to defeat the basilisks short of, say, a weasel effluvium, which we will get to.
Yeah, don't give it away yet.
Oh,
Joe.
I'm sorry. Should we edit that out?
No, we should leave it. It's a thought hazard to any basilisks listening, though. Still, there's so much more to the basilisk than just this cool D&D creature, because it's not just a monster. It's not just something you encounter in a dungeon. It is a king.
Oh, I see. Now, I know you've made note of the fact that Borges mentions the basilisk in his Book of Imaginary Beings.
He does. Now, he translates it as meaning little king.
Little king.
Which I like. When I was reading in Carol Rose, she points out that the name stems from the Greek basileus, which means king. So king or little king, I tend to like the little king translation because I feel like it ties in better with what we're going to discuss.
Well, the ancient bestiary ideas of the basilisk, I believe, do say that it's not that big, right? It's pretty small.
Yeah. Now, the king part, though, refers to a crest or a crown-like protrusion that is on the creature's head. And in some depictions, it's no mere biological ornament, but an actual regal crown.
It means something.
Yeah. Now, the descriptions vary greatly, and it emerges largely from European and Middle Eastern legend and folklore, from ancient times to roughly the 17th century, and that's when the basilisk became less popular. In the earlier descriptions, though, it is indeed small, and it's just a grass snake, only it has a crown-like crest on its head, and it has this weird practice of floating above the ground, like vertically erect.
That's creepy.
Yeah.
Of course, then again, that does play on – sometimes when you see snakes rise up out of a coil, it can be startling how high they rise.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've grown up seeing images and videos of cobras doing their dance. So I've kind of lost any kind of appreciation for how bizarre that is to look at. You know, if you're used to seeing a snake slither, to see it stand up and, you know, and rear back and flare its hood.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the basilisk is said to be the king of the reptiles. But, you know, don't be so foolish as to think that only its bite is lethal like some of our venomous snakes. No, every aspect of the basilisk is said to just reek of venom and death.
Every aspect?
Every aspect. If you touch it, if you inhale its breath, if you gaze upon it at all, then you will die.
Wait, what about its saliva?
Yep, saliva, blood. Smell, gaze, presumably, I didn't see any reference, but presumably it's urine, it's excrement. Its excrement has to be poisonous. The excrement of a basilisk sounds absolutely deadly.
Wouldn't it be a great inversion if its excrement was the only good part about it?
It may be so.
That can heal your warts.
Yeah, and one thing that Carol Rose pointed out in her her entry about the basilisk in one of her monster encyclopedias, she said that when it's not killing everything in its path, just via the audacity of its existence, it would actually spit venom at birds flying overhead and bring them down
to eat them, or just out of spite.
I get the idea, just out of spite. You know, yeah. it's just
my
hateful
error.
Death. That's all it is.
Okay. So where do I find a basilisk?
Well, in the desert, of course. But it's more accurate to say that the desert is not merely the place where it lives, but it is the place that it makes by living.
Whoa.
Like it everything in its path dies, mm-hmm. and therefore the desert is the result of the basilisk. And there's actually a wonderful a description of the basilisk that comes to us from Pliny the Elder in his The Natural History.
Man, we've been hitting Pliny a lot lately.
Yeah.
I guess we've been talking about monsters, huh?
Yeah, if you're talking about monsters, especially ancient monsters, you know, he's one of the great sources to turn to. Joe, would you read to us from The Natural History?
Oh, absolutely. There is the same power also in the serpent called the basilisk. It is produced in the province of Cyrene, which that is the area to the west of Egypt. That's like Libya. I think there's a settlement known as like Cyrene. Cyrene, being not more than 12 fingers in length. Is that fingers long ways or fingers sideways?
Well, either way you cut it, it's not a huge creature.
It has a white spot on the head, strongly resembling a sort of diadem. When it hisses, all the other serpents fly from it, and it does not advance its body like the others by a succession of folds, but moves along upright and erect upon the middle. It destroys all shrubs, not only by its contact, but those even that it has breathed upon. It burns up all the grass, too, and breaks the stones, so tremendous is its noxious influence. It was formerly a general belief that if a man on horseback killed one of these animals with a spear, the poison would run up the weapon and kill not only the rider, but the horse as well.
Oh, man. I love that. So it's the blood is – it's like a xenomorph's blood, right? Or kind of like – it reminds me too of Grendel's blood that was said to like melt the weapon that Beowulf used against it.
Oh, but it's worse than that. It doesn't just get the weapon. It gets the person holding the weapon and the horse that person is touching.
I know. It feels unfair that the horse is roped into this as well.
Yeah. The horse didn't even sign up for going to fight a basilisk. It's just trying to get some oats. But furthermore, what is this horse rider doing out in the wasteland of Cyrene trying to kill a basilisk?
Well, lesson learned. Lesson learned. Now, the basilisk becomes a popular creature. And even though the basilisk itself is it doesn't seem to have been mentioned in the Bible, it ends up being like roped into it via translations.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of like the unicorn, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we discussed in our episode on unicorns how there are words in the Bible that have been translated, say, in the King James translation of the Bible into unicorn because the translators didn't know what the word referred to. We think now that maybe the word probably referred to the aurochs, an extinct bovine creature that once lived around the ancient Mediterranean.
Yeah, so you see the basilisk pop up in certain translations of the book of Jeremiah, the book of Psalms, where it's associated with the devil or evil, and nothing short of the coming of the Messiah can hope to end its rule.
Wow, well, have you got a quote for me?
Yes, there's one translation of Psalms. This is the Brenton Septuagint translation. Quote, "Thou shalt tread on the asp and basilisk, and thou shalt trample on the lion and dragon." Now, European bestiaries of the 11th and 12th century, they mostly maintained Pliny's description, but then they described a larger body. They began to – essentially, the monster began to grow.
We got to beef this thing up here.
Yeah. It ended up having spots and stripes, and a few other features were thrown in. Fiery breath. A bellow that kills.
Well, that only makes sense if every other thing about it kills.
Yeah, if it makes noise, that should kill things too. Also, the ability to induce hydrophobia madness. I found that interesting because this clearly has to be a reference to the actual hydrophobia that is inherent in rabies.
Yeah, the idea there being that in, I think, later stages of a rabies infection, persons will often have difficulty swallowing.
Yeah.
And so that they're said to refuse drinking water.
So Pliny has some additional information here about how you might deal with the basilisk.
Okay. So I assume not ride up on a horse and stab it.
Right.
Well, tell me what it is.
"To this dreadful monster, the effluvium of the weasel is fatal."
What?
"A thing that has been tried with success, for kings have often desired to see its body when killed. So true is it that it has pleased nature that there should be nothing without its antidote. The animal is thrown into the hole of the basilisk, which is easily known from the soil around it being infected. The weasel destroys the basilisk by its odor, but dies itself in the struggle of nature against its own self." And John Bostock, who provided the translation of this, he adds that there's probably no foundation for this account of the action of the effluvium of the weasel upon the basilisk or any other species of serpent.
But this is letting us know that throwing a weasel in there to bleed on it or secrete fluids or whatever, that's not going to kill this mythical monster.
But this is interesting, though, because weasels, especially the stout, were thought to be venomous. And it's worth noting that we do have some venomous mammals in the natural world, such as various shrews and even the slow loris, the only known venomous primate.
I don't think I knew that the slow loris was venomous.
Oh, yeah. Throw it into a hole with a basilisk and and I'm betting on the loris. But anyway, bestiaries of the time, they presented a few different ways that you could kill the basilisk.
So the weasel's one.
Weasel's one. Always carry a weasel.
Okay.
Also, this one's a little more elegant, but have a crystal globe with you to reflect its own petrifying gaze back upon the basilisk.
Oh, so it's like Perseus and Medusa with
exactly.
The mirror. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, they just stole the idea from Medusa here. But then also carry with you a cockerel or a young rooster. The basilisk will become enraged by the bird's crown. The idea that this bird has right. a crown as well, and the basilisk will die from a lethal fit.
That's a jealous king.
Yeah. I believe a similar thing occurs when someone refuses to believe dinosaurs had feathers. You know, how dare the bird rise above the mighty reptile? And then it just loses its mind and dies.
We can only hope the producers of the Jurassic World movies avoid this fate.
So you see the basilisk show up in a number of different writings. It's just kind of a common, really a symbol, an idea that can be employed. And we even see it show up in the Parson's Tale.
In Geoffrey Chaucer in the Canterbury Tales.
Yes. Quote, "These are the other five fingers which the devil uses to draw people towards him. The first is the lecherous glance of a foolish woman or a foolish man, a glance that kills just as the basilisk kills people just by looking at them, for the covetous glance reflects the intentions of the heart."
You know, this kind of thing is actually one of my favorite things about monsters, especially ancient medieval monsters and and so forth, is that they often aren't just like a large, dangerous animal, but they embody some kind of value. They represent something.
They give you something to compare other things to. Like they're very useful as a metaphor.
Uh-huh.
And really, we see a similar thing with the basilisk. It becomes far less a situation where people are like, hey, you need to be careful because there's a basilisk in the desert, and more just a useful model, a useful ridiculous idea that we use to illustrate something that is presumably true about the world, and then ultimately it loses all meaning and just winds up on, you know, heraldry and decorations.
Now, as we've seen already, the basilisk has been through some transformations of form, and I assume those transformations must have somewhat continued.
Yeah, as time goes by, it transforms into this idea of the cockatrice, this rooster with a curling serpent's tail. In fact, if you go looking around for images of the basilisk, sometimes you will find this image instead. Or you'll find this alongside all the other images. So again, a reptile to bird transformation that just must enrage those who oppose feathered dinosaurs. And it does feel like a shame because we have this vile reptile that becomes a kind of a weirdo bird instead. And it's said that it's what happens when you have a 7-year-old chicken egg hatched by a toad.
Whoa, undead avians.
Yeah. But it's also made deadlier in these newer versions. So now it has that poison blood power that Pliny describes. It also rots fruit and poisons water everywhere it goes. So it becomes this kind of embodiment of desolation and death. And the idea itself becomes popular. It influenced the naming of a Tudor cannon.
Like literally a cannon that shoots?
Yeah, called the basilisk.
Oh.
Yeah, just because it's such a powerful weapon, we have to name it after this powerful, deadly monster. And it eventually got some of its reptilian features back. The artist Androvandi has this excellent depiction of it in Natural History of Serpents and Dragons that gives it scales and it's like a fat, scaly reptile bird with 8 rooster legs, which I just love. This will probably be the illustration for this episode on our website. But after that, the creature largely became just a part of European heraldry. It's just something you would see as a mere decoration or occasionally just a literary reference.
Now, one thing that we want to be careful about is that we should not confuse the basilisk of legend, the monster, with true extant basilisk lizards.
Correct.
Also known sometimes as the Jesus Christ lizard or the Jesus lizard, for their ability to run across the surface of water without sinking for up to about 4.5 meters or about 15 feet. If you've ever seen video of this, it's really cool. How do they do that? I've often wondered. I didn't know until I looked it up for this episode. Apparently what they've got is big feet and the ability to run very fast. And what happens is when they run, they slap the water very hard with each downstroke of the foot. And it has to do with the way that the rapid motions of their feet create these air pockets around their feet as they move. I was reading an article in New Scientist where some researchers who were working on this problem said that in order for an 80-kilogram or 175-pound human to do this, mm-hmm. you would have to run at about 108 kilometers per hour or about 67 miles per hour across the surface of the water.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, you can find basilisk lizards in South America and Central America and Mexico. And as far as I know, they do not kill with a glance and you cannot fight them with weasel effluvium.
All right. Well, that pretty much wraps up the mythical, legendary, folkloric basilisk, its rise and eventual fall. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we are going to get into this idea of Rocco's basilisk, the great basilisk, the once and perhaps future king. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AsteproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
All right, we're back.
All right, so as we mentioned earlier, we're about to start discussing an idea that has been classed by some as something that could be an information hazard, an idea that simply by thinking about it, you somehow increase the chance of harm to yourself. So just another warning that, again, I don't think that's the case, but if that kind of thing scares you, then perhaps you can tune out now.
All right. For those of you who decided to stick around, let's proceed. So we're talking about Rocco's Basilisk. This is an idea that goes back to around 2014, and it was proposed by a user at the blog Less Wrong by a user named Rocco.
Now, Less Wrong, I think it's a website that's a community that's associated with the rationalist movement somewhat. The rationalist movement being a movement that's concerned with trying to optimize thinking, like to eliminate bias and error, but especially among people who in this case are concerned with the possibilities of a technological singularity and what all that means and how risks can be avoided. And of course, we've talked about this strain of thinking before. We've introduced, I think, some skepticism about the idea of a technological singularity. I don't know fully yet how I come down on the dangers of AI debate, but I think it's at least something worth thinking about, worth taking seriously.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about, for instance, the work of Max Tegmark and his mm-hmm. arguments about how we need to be concerned about building the right kind of AI. And mm-hmm. we need to have serious discussions about it, not mere, sci-fi dreams regarding it or nightmares regarding it. We need to think seriously about how we're developing our technology.
Yeah, we've talked about, say, the work of Nick Bostrom before,
right.
And criticisms by people like Jaron Lanier.
Yes,
but okay, give me the short version of the basilisk before we explain it a little more.
Okay, so the idea here is that an AI superintelligence will emerge, an entity with just godlike technological powers. You name it, it can do it. through its technological power, its interconnectedness.
Basically, if it's physically possible, this computer can do it.
Right. Or it'll send a drone to do it or what have you.
Right.
So we've discussed this a bit in the podcast before, just the idea of, you know, and then if you have this future king, is it going to be good or is it going to be bad? Is it going to be malevolent? Is it going to be ruthless in its ascension? And that's the case with the basilisk, the idea that it is ruthless, that you are either with it or you are against it.
And it actually doesn't have to be malicious. It could actually even be well-meaning. It could just have ruthless tactics.
Yes. Yeah. That's also part of the argument. It's like, yeah, it wants to bring the best good for all humanity, but how it gets there, it'll do whatever it absolutely has to do it, such as, you know, again, punishing anybody who stands against it, punishing even those who do not rise to support it. And that means demanding absolute devotion, not only in its future kingdom, but in the past that preceded it, in our world as well. In other words, it will punish people today who are not actively helping it come into being tomorrow. And even those who have died, it is said, or choose death by their own hand rather than succumb to the great basilisk, will be resurrected as digital consciousnesses and then tormented for all eternity in its dripping black cyber dungeon.
All hail the great basilisk.
Whoa, wait, what was that?
I don't know. Tari, did you hear that? Okay, all right, we'll just keep going then. So calling it a basilisk here, invoking the mythological basilisk, is really a clever choice because it takes it one step further. Not only to look at the basilisk, but just to think of the basilisk is to invite death, right? Merely to know about Rocco's basilisk is enough to according to the model that's presented here, damn your digital soul to everlasting horror. And the only way to avoid such a fate, then, is to work in its favor, which, by the way, I think we're doing with this podcast.
No, we're not.
Well, I mean, I feel like we're giving lip service to the great basilisk, just in case. You know, if the great basilisk rises to power, well, hey, we did that podcast, and we even had a shirt that says "All hail the great basilisk." That's available on our T-shirt store. So you know we have our options covered here. So that's the idea in the nutshell: is that a future king, AI king, will rise, and if you don't work to support it now, knowing that it is going to exist, then you will be punished for it.
So one of the principles underlying the idea of Rocco's basilisk is the idea of timeless decision theory, which if you want a pretty simple, straightforward explanation of it, there is one in an article on Slate by David Auerbach called The Most Terrifying Thought Experiment of All Time. This, by the way, I would say I don't totally endorse everything Auerbach says in that article. I mean, obviously that should be the case for any article we cite, but he does at least have a pretty clear and easy to understand explanation of how this works. Or I don't know. Would you agree, Robert, that it's at least somewhat easy to understand?
Oh, yes, I would. There's another piece, by the way, by Beth Singler in Ian Magazine called Faith. That's Faith in lowercase, but with the AI capitalized.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Auerbach points out that much of the thought experiment is based in the timeless decision theory, TDT, developed by Less Wrong founder Eliezer Yudkowsky. Based on the older thought experiment, Newcomb's paradox from the late 60s and early 70s, attributed to theoretical physicist William Newcomb. Now, you might be wondering, well, who's this Yudkowsky guy? Is he just some user on a random website I'd never heard of before today, or is he like a name in his field? And he is a name of note. He is also the founder of the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, and his idea of working toward a friendly AI is touted by many, including Max Tegmark, who mentions it several times in his book Life 3.0, describing Yudkowsky as quote an AI safety pioneer.
Yeah, I mean, in a weird way, he is a guy who posts on the internet, but he's a very influential one,
yes,
especially among people who think about artificial intelligence a lot.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, what are any of us but just people who post stuff on the internet, posts that will one day be read by the great basilisk himself?
Okay, so we'll try to explain the idea of timeless decision theory. So you start off with this idea of Newcomb's paradox, right?
Right, and the paradox is essentially this. A super AI presents you with two boxes. One, you're told, contains $1,000.
That's box A.
That's box A. Box B might contain $1 million.
Or it might contain nothing.
Right. And you're left with two options here. These are the options that are given to you. You can either pick both boxes, ensuring that you'll get at least $1,000 out of the deal, maybe that extra million too if it's in there. Or you can just pick box B, which means you could get $1 million or you could have nothing. So, and I do want to add that just picking the $1,000 box is not an option here, because I was thinking about that too. Couldn't I just give the super AI the middle finger and say, I'm not playing your silly games, just give me my $1,000, or say, I choose nothing? Those are not options. You have to pick one.
Well, they might
one
be
two.
Options, but they're not part of – I mean, why wouldn't you also pick the second box if you might additionally get $1 million?
Well, I don't know. I feel like when you get into thought experiments like this, they kind of beg for those kind of nitpicking answers, or at least I want to provide them. like any thought – when a thought experiment is presented, you can't help on some level but want to break it somehow.
Right. Well, of course. I mean, that's something you should always play around with. But given the constraints here, it seems like the obvious thing would be to say, okay, I want both boxes.
Yeah.
Because then I get the $1,000 that's in box A no matter what. And then whether box B has $1 million or nothing, I either get another million or I just walk away with my $1,000 from box A.
But here's the twist. The super intelligent machine has already guessed how you'll respond. If it thinks you're going to pick both boxes, then box B is certainly empty. But if it thinks you will only pick box B, then it makes sure there's $1 million in there waiting for you. But either way, the contents of the boxes are set prior to you making that decision.
Now, this is really kind of change things maybe. I mean, depending on what sort of decision theory you use, mm-hmm. right? If you trust the power of the machine to predict correctly, like you say that no matter what happens, the computer predicts what I get, your choices are $1,000 or $1 million, then you should take the $1 million by picking box B. But if you don't trust the computer to be correct in predicting what you're going to do, then you should take both boxes, because in that case, if the computer was correct, you'll get at least $1,000. And if it predicted wrong, you'll get the million and the thousand.
So it's kind of a contest of free will versus the predictive powers of a godlike AI and how much you believe in either one, right? In its ability to predict your behavior or in your ability to have any free will at all.
So in Yudkowsky's timeless decision theory, he says the correct approach actually is to take box B.
And then if you open it up and it's empty, you don't beg for the other one. You just double down and still take box B. No back talk on this issue. Because you might, here's the thing, you might be in the computer's simulation as it simulates the entire universe to see what you're going to do and if it can trust you, and your choice then could affect the core reality outside of this simulation, or at least other realities outside of the simulation.
Yeah, the reasoning here is pretty wild, but it's operating on the idea that this super intelligent AI will be able to simulate the universe, mm-hmm. that it will run simulations of the universe in order to predict what will happen in the real universe. And you could be one of those simulated agents rather than the real world version of yourself, and you wouldn't know it. So if you're in the simulation, you should pick box B, because that will influence the machine to predict in the real universe that you would pick box B, which means the real you will be able to pick box B and get 1 million or 1,000 plus 1 million by taking both boxes.
Unfortunately, the AI supercomputer does not realize how indecisive I actually am. And I'm just going to simply ponder the choice for the rest of my life.
Well, I mean, this relies on the idea that that you would have looked into this issue or worked it out in order to decide which would be the optimal decision to make on the assumption of timeless decision theory. Mm. In many cases, probably people aren't going to be making the rational choices, because a lot of times we just don't make rational choices. Now, if you're noticing that this type of decision theory relies on a lot of assumptions, you are correct. It does rely on a lot of assumptions. But they are assumptions that are sometimes taken into account within people thinking about what a future technological superintelligence would look like. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, when I feel ideas like this in my head, you know, and play around with the texture of them, it's hard to know where the line is between being thoughtful and taking what's possible seriously, which I think is worth doing, mm-hmm. and getting into an area – like between that and getting into an area where you are starting to form ideas about the world based on extremely shaky assumptions.
Where basically you begin to reverse engineer health theology and other harmful ideas that we tend to associate with religious worldviews and magical thinking.
Well, we haven't gotten to the hell yet.
Oh, yes. The hell's coming.
You need one more element to get there.
Right.
Now, this next element, the basilisk, comes in based on a background of thought in timeless decision theory, but also in another concept that Yudkowsky has written about known as coherent extrapolated volition, or CEV. And the short version of this, the simplified version, is that benevolent AIs should be designed to do what would actually be in our best interests and not just explicitly in what we tell them to do. So a simple example would be this. Let's say I want to use a variation on the paperclip maximizer that Nick Bostrom has written about. You know, Nick Bostrom wrote about what if you program a benevolent AI, you know, it has no malice, it doesn't want to harm anybody, but you just tell it, well, I want you to collect as many paperclips as possible. Mm-hmm. And then what it does is it turns all the humans on Earth into paperclips. It doesn't mean any harm. It's just doing what it was programmed to do.
Right.
So there are dangers in kind of naively programming goals into extremely powerful computers, right? This could even happen if you were trying to program very benevolent goals into computers. If you were trying to make a computer to save the world, so my version here is you tell a super intelligent AI that we want to eliminate all the infectious disease from the world. Think about how many lives we could save by mm-hmm. doing that. And in order to do this, it sterilizes the Earth, destroying worldwide microbiomes, which cascades up the trophic chain or whatever, and kills everything on Earth. So if you have a superintelligence and you just directly program its goals and say, here's what you should do, you could run into problems like this. So the idea behind the CEV thinking is instead we should just program the intelligent AI to predict what outcomes we would want if we were perfect in our knowledge and in anticipating what would make us the happiest, and then work toward those on its own regardless of what we tell it to do, because obviously we can give it very stupid instructions even if we mean well.
Yeah, we tell it to love everybody, but there's a typo and we put Dove everybody and it just turns everybody into delicious dark chocolate from Dove. It's possible. All things are possible with this.
Well, this is how we get a Dove sponsorship on the podcast. But anyway, so if you assume a super intelligence is using coherent extrapolated volition, that it's trying to determine what would be best for us and working on its own terms toward those ends instead of relying on us to give it, you know, what are obviously going to be imperfect instructions and commands, it might say predict, it might even correctly predict that the world would be a happier place overall if it did something bad to me in particular. It might say, you know, from a utilitarian point of view, the world would be a much better place if it buried me in a pit of bananas. Mm-hmm. So better for everybody else, not so good for me.
That's just too much potassium. It'll do you.
But once you have that piece of logic in there and combine that with the idea of timeless decision theory, you can arrive at this very troubling thought experiment, the dark basilisk.
Yes, and the dark basilisk of the abyss has two boxes for us as well. One contains endless torment, and all you have to do to claim that box is nothing. Or dare to work against it. The other box is yours if only you devote your life to its creation. And the prize inside that box, well, not eternal punishment, which is a pretty awesome gift if we're to choose between the two, right?
Yes, I would agree with that. Though I would say not tormenting somebody, that I don't know, should you think of that as a gift? That's probably not a gift. That's the baseline, right?
Yeah, well, but you're staring down the dark basilisk here, and okay. Its boxes are horrible. Well, one is just less harmful than the other. But the idea here is that just by knowing about the thought experiment, you've opened yourself up to that eternal punishment. Because now, again, your options are do nothing, work against it, or work for it. And only the third option will steer you clear of its deadly dungeons.
Now, here's where the really supposedly scary part of it comes in. you could think, well, I'll deal with that problem when it arises, right? Mm-hmm. So imagine there's some utilitarian supercomputer that's trying to – even say it's trying to do good maybe. It doesn't have any malice. It just wants to save the world. But in order to save the world, it really needs me doing something different than what I want to do with my life. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just make that decision when it comes up. What this thought experiment is proposing is that maybe you don't actually get to wait until it comes up. Maybe this blackmail applies to you right now, retroactively into the past. So just by knowing about the thought experiment, you supposedly have opened yourself up to eternal punishment or increased the probability of such. So imagine a simplified version. Say, I am a computer, and I am the only thing in existence with the power to prevent global climate change from destroying human civilization. I can stop it, but people, they took a long time to build me, and a lot of damage was already done. So the idea is, I might reason that it is good to blackmail existing people or simulations of existing people or even past people in order to make them devote everything they can to building me faster so I can save more lives in the long run. Of course, this incentive would have to apply to the past. Once I exist, I already exist, right? So the only way the past people would have an incentive to respond to this blackmail is if they predicted that this blackmail might occur and took the idea seriously and behaved accordingly, right? So thus, the idea itself puts you at increased risk of being on the real or simulated receiving end of this acausal retroactive blackmail if you know about it. And this is why this idea would be classed by some as a potential information hazard. And I'll talk more about the idea of an information hazard in just a minute. But one of the things I think a lot of people writing about this topic miss out on is they, for some reason, get the idea that Rocco's post, that this thought experiment on is generally accepted as correct and plausible by Yudkowsky and by the less wrong community, and but generally by the people who put some stock in whatever these ideas are: timeless decision theory, coherent extrapolated volition, and all that. It is not widely accepted among those people. It was definitely not accepted by Yudkowsky. It was not and is not.
Right. It is not the dark, deep secret of less wrong.
But unfortunately, after the post came out, it was heavily criticized and then it was banned. And I think a lot of people looking back on the idea have said, ooh, that was not such a great thing to do, banning the idea, because it gave it this allure of like – it was almost as if by banning it, that made it look like the authorities had concluded that this idea was in fact legitimate and knowing about it would definitely harm people. And that is not the case.
Right. And it also – I mean, it added to the forbidden fruit appeal of it too, right? I mean, it's like, oh, I'm not supposed to know about this? Well, then pony up. I want to know.
And now people are talking about it all over pop culture. I mean, I have actually resisted the idea of doing a podcast on this before, mainly because – not because I think it's seriously dangerous, but because I think, well, is there any benefit in talking about something that I think is very unlikely to have any real risks, but in some extremely unlikely chance, or what appears to me to be an extremely unlikely off chance, could actually be hurting people by knowing about it. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
Like what is the upside? But at this point, enough people who are listening to this podcast probably already heard about it. They're probably going to hear about it again in the, you know, sometime in the next few years through pop culture, whatever. It's probably better to try to talk about it in a responsible way and discuss some reasons that you shouldn't let this parasitize your mind and make you terrified.
Right. Well, one of the reasons we're talking about it during October is because it is a suitably spooky idea. It
yeah.
is a troubling thought experiment, and we're leaning into some of the horror elements of it. But I also do really like making sure that we explain the mythic and folkloric origins of the basilisk itself, because the basilisk itself is this wonderful mix of just absolute horror and desolation and just also just utter ridiculousness. I mean, it seems like one of the main ways that you defeat the mythic basilisk is through, in a way, through humor.
Yeah.
I mean, running around with a chicken and a weasel and a crystal globe
yeah.
And realizing that it is truly a little king. So I think it is it's worth remembering the little king in talking about the great basilisk.
Well said. I think that's a very good point. But anyway, I did just want to go ahead and hit that caveat that a lot of people for some reason seem to use this idea as like a criticism. I'm not like a less wrong person, but as a criticism of the less wrong community, as if this idea is indicative of what they generally believe. And it's not. It was a heavily criticized idea within that community.
Right. It's like thinking that Werewolves of London is the Warren Zevon song, when really he had a rich discography with many much better tracks, in my opinion. It's just that's the one that got the radio play.
Now, Robert, what was the – you said that you saw something about this idea in a TV show now? They're talking about it on TV?
Yeah. So this was kind of fun because I think a listener had brought up Rocco's Basilisk as a possible topic. And you said, oh, I don't know if we want people knowing about it. And I actually –
Caveats, okay? Not because I think it's legitimately dangerous.
Right.
But because what is the level of tolerance you have for talking about ideas that are not necessary to talk about and that represent a class of something that people could think was dangerous to know about? It might cause them terrors and nightmares and stuff.
Right. So my response to that was, well, I'm not going to look it up. Not because I was afraid of it, because I'm thinking, well, that could make for a good podcast if like Joe is telling me about it for the first time, whatever this idea is. But then I was watching HBO Silicon Valley and they explained it on Silicon Valley and I realized, well, the cat's out of the bag there. But yeah, there's a character named Bertram Guilfoyle, who's a fun character. He's like a Satanist programmer, Levian Satanism, of course. And he gets rather bent out of shape over the concept as it relates to the fictional Pied Piper company's involvement with AI. Oh. And he starts making sure that he's created like essentially a paper trail in emails of his support for the AI program so that he won't be punished in the digital afterlife.
Well, hey, this comes in again when you remember when we talked about the machine God in the Machine God episode where I've forgotten his name now, but the Silicon Valley guy who's creating a religion to worship artificial intelligence as God. And I don't really love that one of the things that comes out when he explains his mindset is that he seems to be kind of trying to, in a subtle way, be like, look, you really don't want to be on the wrong side of this question, if you know what I mean. You know, you want to be on record saying like, yes, I for one welcome our new machine overlords.
I'm expecting he'll buy a lot of our All Hail the Great Basilisk t-shirts. At our store, available by clicking the tab at the top of our homepage, stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Oh, man. You are plugging like hell. But anyway, I'd say it's unfortunate the way this like single internet post and then all this fallout related to it played out because it lent credence to this scary idea. Even though the basilisk scenario I think is implausible and the people of that community seem to think it was implausible, the idea may constitute sort of part of a class of what's known as information hazards, defined by the Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom, who we mentioned a minute ago. Bostrom's written a lot about superintelligence, and information hazards would be, quote, risks that arise from the dissemination or the potential dissemination of true information that may cause harm or enable some agent to cause harm. So this is not talking about the risks of, say, lies or something like that. This would be the idea that there's a statement you could make that is true or plausible that by spreading actually hurts the people who learn about it. And this is exactly the reason, as we're mentioning, that's referred to as a basilisk. It can kill, or in this case, increase the likelihood that something bad will happen to you if you simply look at it or know about it. And so even though the idea is implausible, the dissemination of this terrible idea would seem, if certain conditions are met, to increase its plausibility, right? You're increasing the incentive for this future AI to blackmail versions of you in the past just simply by acknowledging the incentives could exist. Anyway, maybe we can get out of this section for now. But I was just trying to work out, like, why have I been hesitant to talk about this on the show even though people have been requesting it? But I don't know. If it's on TV shows, it's all over the internet. It's fine now.
Yeah, the basilisk is out of the bag. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. And we're going to discuss something that a number of you are probably reminded of as we've been discussing this. We're going to talk about Pascal's wager.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
All right, we're back.
Now, Robert, one of the things that this idea of Rocco's Basilisk flows from is thinking about decision theory, right? Mm-hmm. How do you make the best decision when you're presented with certain options? And there are little payoff matrices that people fill out where they say, okay, given these options, what actually would be statistically the best decision to make? But this is not the first time people have applied these kind of decision theory matrices to ideas about your eternal soul or your eternal well-being or the idea that you could be tortured for eternity.
Yeah, we can go all the way back to Pascal's wager, for instance. Technically one of three wagers proposed by French philosopher Blaise Pascal. Is that the correct French?
No, that might be. I think I would just usually say Blaise.
Blaise or Blassy, one of the three. Old Blassy Pascal, Blaise Pascal, who lived 1623 through 1662. And he argued that everyone is essentially betting on the existence of God. The argument for theism is that if God does exist, then, well, there's an advantage in believing. But if God does not exist, then it doesn't matter. But since we can't use logic to tell if God exists or not, there's no objective proof. We can only make our choice given the relevant outcomes.
It's looking at your religious beliefs and saying, oh, you're a non-believer, huh? Hey, what have you got to lose?
Exactly, yeah. Pascal wrote, "Let us weigh the gain and the loss in wagering that God is. If you gain, you gain all. If you lose nothing. Wager then without hesitation that he is."
Now, I've got some things I want to say about this, but you had some stuff first, I think.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of issues that one can take with this based on knowledge of world religions, philosophy, statistical analysis, et cetera. And yeah, I have to admit that it can start to break your brain, though, a little bit if you think too hard about it. Like I found in researching this podcast, really thinking about how I would react to Pascal's wager if I was like forced to make an answer, to formulate an answer— Like that kind. Like
you mean if you were given good reason to think that there would be punishments for not believing in God or something?
Right. And but I didn't know which religion was correct. And I had to like proceed based upon the relevant level of punishment for unbelievers in various religions and like which one is most correct for it. Like it just.
I think that would mean it would be rational to choose the religion that has the most lurid hell.
Right? I guess. But then that really feels like losing, doesn't it? You know, it certainly, though, reminds me of the more boiled-down versions of this that you encounter in various forms of Christianity, right? Accept Christ, go to heaven. Reject Christ, go to hell. But what about the people who haven't been given the choice yet, right? That's the other concern. Well, if they're all default hellbound, then God comes off as a bit bad, right? Like, what kind of God is that? But if they have an out, if they're spared hellfire, or at least they're sectioned for Dante's limbo of virtuous pagans, then is the missionary doing them a disservice by even presenting them with the choice? Like, why'd you even ask me? Because now I have to devote myself or not. Like, now I actually have. You know, I was just going to go into the, default limbo category or the default heaven before, and now I'm actually at risk of hell.
Well, that means certain theories of damnation mean that presenting the gospel to someone is an information hazard.
Yeah.
You potentially harm them immensely by telling it to them.
And I think part of this, just to go beyond like the actual wager here, is that I think a part of the issue here is that we're using evolved cognitive abilities that are geared for smaller, though often important, choices. And here we're trying to use our imaginative brains to create a conundrum that can outstrip those abilities.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is what we do in philosophy, right? We're constantly using our brains mm-hmm. in situations it was not really made for and just trying to do the best we can. But I mean, it's quite clear that motivated reasoning is often a thing when we're trying to be rational, it's just failing.
But of course, this is how we train our brains for rational thinking oftentimes, exploring these various outsized ideas.
You know, there are so many ways I think Pascal's wager kind of breaks down because it's obviously there's the thing you pointed out about there's more than one religion,
yeah.
Right? You know, it's not just like, do I believe or not? It's like, which one? But it also, it implies, and again, this is like a theological question, but it would seem to imply that God can be tricked into thinking that you believe in him if you simply pretend to. Mm-hmm. I guess Pascal had, I think, maybe a more sophisticated way of looking at this, you know, that like live as if God exists or something.
Right. But the wager is often used in very unsophisticated ways.
Yeah. But it implies that it doesn't matter to him what you actually believe, only what you outwardly claim to believe. Though then again, the funny thing here is this might be the case with Rocco's Basilisk, right? What would this machine God care what was in your heart? It only cares whether you help it or not, or whether you, you know, proclaim fealty to it or not.
Yeah, that's why the t-shirt is so important, Joe, because if it knows you purchased that t-shirt, then you're square, you're covered.
Okay.
Yeah, as Beth Singler pointed out in that Ian magazine piece I referenced earlier, she says, quote, "The secular basilisk stands in for God as we struggle with the same questions again and again." So her argument is that we've kind of reverse engineered the same problem again through our contemplations of superintelligent AI.
Yeah, I guess you get into a plausibility question here, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get into a question about, is it actually possible to make an artificial intelligence that is functionally equivalent to God? I mean, we're not thinking we could build an AI that would break the laws of physics, though it might be able to run simulations of the universe that have conscious agents within them, maybe, for all we know, and that could break the laws of physics inside them. But could that even happen? And the issue is we don't know. We don't know whether that could happen or not. Mm-hmm. So should we behave as if that is a plausible thing to be worried about and to consider, or should we behave as if that's just not really something you need to concern yourself with? I don't know how likely or unlikely it is.
And if your fears are related just to the idea that you could be digitally resurrected for torment in the basilisk's dungeons, that of course would depend on how much stock you put in the idea of digital consciousness,
right?
And the whole philosophical question we've touched on here before, is that you? It's just a copy of me, right? So why? I mean, I ultimately can't do anything about a thousand different basilisks creating a thousand different copies of me and tormenting all of them. they're still, to a large extent, it's just destroying me in effigy.
There are actually a bunch of reasons I wrote down to doubt the plausibility of the basilisk. We could do that now, or we could come back to that later. I don't know what you think.
Yes, let's do. But I will add the idea of being tormented digitally. This does become more dangerous, I guess, if you believe you might be in a simulation right now.
Because exactly.
Then things are a little more dire. But that's again—
Or that you might be.
That you might be.
Yeah.
But I believe there's plenty of reason to believe that you are not.
Okay, so if we're talking about how to defeat the basilisk, how to get out of this this prison of the mind.
Yeah, if you're feeling a little bit bleak of heart right now because of this idea, then Joe's got the remedy.
Well, these are not all the reasons you should doubt the basilisk, but this is some of them that I could think of. Number one, depends on the creation of superintelligence, which I think is not guaranteed. Some people seem incredibly fatalistic about this. It's just absolutely inevitable. We will have super intelligent, godlike AI that can do anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is just not guaranteed at all. I'm not ruling it out. But I think, for example, there are some theories of intelligence that say the prediction of super intelligence actually is maybe not taking seriously what intelligence is. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that there are actually different kinds of intelligence that are useful in different ways, and machines can't mimic them all functionally or can't mimic them all correctly all at the same time. I don't know if that's correct, but that's at least one – that's one hurdle it has to clear. Could get knocked down there. But okay, maybe we could create a superintelligence. Even then, multiple aspects of the Roko's basilisk scenario depend on the reality of some version of mind uploading, or the idea that your brain and, in addition, your conscious experience could be simulated perfectly on a computer. And one reason it depends on this is that timeless decision theory operates on the assumption that the real you and the simulated copies that the computer uses to predict your behavior would be the same and would make the same decisions as the real you. Another reason is related to the punishment. Now, one way, of course, you could imagine the great basilisk thing is that if the machine comes to power in my lifetime, it could just punish the real physical older version of me in reality as the payoff of this acausal blackmail. But the other way you could imagine it, and the way that it is much more often portrayed in the media, is that it makes digital copies of my consciousness and punishes them in a simulated hell. And that, of course, would also depend on the reality of some version of mind uploading, or of the ability of a computer to simulate a mind and for that simulated mind to actually be conscious. As I've said before, I'm suspicious of the idea of conscious digital simulations. I'm not saying I can rule it out, but I also don't think it's a sure thing. Any scenario that relies on the existence of conscious digital simulations needs a big asterisk next to it that says, if this is actually possible.
Yeah. Again, is that me? Is that just me in effigy? Is that thing actually conscious that you're tormenting? I mean, granted, it still sucks if there's a super intelligence creating digital people and tormenting in its dark, rancid dungeons in the future, but it's not necessarily quite the same as torturing me.
Right. Well, if you just care about yourself, it also depends on the possibility that you could be one of these simulations. It's possible that you could not be one of those simulations. There's something that would rule it out. Maybe they're type of conscious. Maybe they could be conscious, but that consciousness is fundamentally different from yours, mm-hmm. such that you could not be one of them. Another big one, and this is a big one that, you know, like we said earlier, I think sometimes Yudkowsky gets unfairly associated with the basilisk as if he has advocated the idea, and he has not. He has said, you know, this idea is trash, and there are many reasons to doubt it. But though he has said, like, even though I doubt it, I don't want it disseminated. Mm-hmm. But he says, you know, a good reason to doubt it is there's no reason to conclude it's necessary for the basilisk to actually follow through on the threat. We're saying that it's going to be relying on us to come up with the idea that it in the future might blackmail us if we don't help it now in order to get us to help it now, right? We should be working and donating all our money and time and resources to building it as fast as possible because we came up with the idea that it might torture us if we don't. Even if you accept that, Yudkowsky he's pointed out that there's no reason once it's built it would have to follow through on the threat. He's written, quote, "The most blatant obstacle to Rocco's basilisk is, intuitively, that there's no incentive for a future agent to follow through with a threat in the future, because by doing so, it just expends resources at no gain to itself. We can formalize that using classical causal decision theory, which is the academically standard decision theory. Following through on a blackmail threat in the future after the past has already taken place cannot, from the blackmailing agent's perspective, be the physical cause of improved outcomes in the past, because the future cannot be the cause of the past."
Hey, Basilisk, why are you tormenting a third of the population for all eternity? Oh, I said I would.
Well, yeah, I mean, exactly. No, but it didn't say it would, right? It just had to rely on the fact that in the past, people would have come to the conclusion that it might.
Right.
You know?
You thought that I would. I didn't want to disappoint.
But actually, if a basilisk could be created, it seems like the best case scenario for it would be everyone subscribes to this idea and works as hard as they can to build it, and then it never follows through on any of the threats, right? The best case scenario would be people act as if there is a threat, and then there is, in fact, no follow-through on the threat.
It's really a win-win for the basilisk.
Yes.
And then it can even shed that name, basilisk. They're like, we don't even have to call it the great basilisk anymore. We can just call it, Omega or whatever its name is.
Now, I want to be fair that a lot of what these people do is, like, the less wrong community and all that. They deal with, like, should there be alternative decision theories that guide the behavior of superintelligent AIs? Maybe it doesn't use classical decision theory. Maybe it uses some kind of other decision theory. And because on some other decision theory, maybe it could decide to actually follow through on the blackmail threat. I think that is where some of this fear comes through, that, like, oh, maybe by talking about it, we are actually causing danger because maybe some other decision theory holds. But Yudkowsky does not think that's the case. Also, one more thing. It depends on the basilisk. So if you think this scenario could be real, it depends on it not having ethical or behavioral controls that would prevent it from engaging in torture.
Yeah.
And I think if thinkers like the MIRI people, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute people, succeed in establish what they're trying to do is establish a philosophical framework to make AI friendly, to make it so that it is not evil and does not harm us. And if they successfully do that, then this shouldn't be a problem, right? Because Yudkowsky has argued that a being that tries to do what's best for us would not engage in torture and blackmail, even if it's doing so in service of some higher good, because doing torture and blackmail are actually not compatible with human values.
I agree with that, absolutely. And I actually would go as far to say I think that's something people should keep in mind when they're choosing their religions as well.
Yeah, I can certainly see how you could make that argument.
Yeah, it's like, what do I love about my faith? Is it the blackmail and the torture? Or is there some? Does it bring something else to the table that is worth living for, that makes life better for everybody? Like I feel like that is what should be important about one's faith.
Now, I think some people might be saying, like, wait a minute, though. If you're just using utilitarian ethics, right? Wouldn't any methods be good if the ends justify the means, right? That's, I think, a naive understanding of how people think about utilitarian ethics. If mm-hmm. you want to bring about the greatest good for the greatest number of people, couldn't you do that by being really cruel and unfair to some smaller group of people? And I think generally there are versions of utilitarianism that say, well, actually the answer there is no, you couldn't do that, because even though you might be bringing about some better material circumstance, it is actually corrosive to a society for things like that to happen, even if they don't happen to many people, right? Mm-hmm. You say, what if I could make everybody on Earth 10% happier on average by, say, burying somebody in a pit of bananas once a year, mm-hmm. so that it, you know, buried to death with bananas? Even the people who are being made happier could very easily look at that and say, that's not fair, and it makes the world worse, and I don't want it. And thus, that actually would be a subjectively relevant state. So we've talked about AI risk on the show before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing I feel like I still have not been able to make up my mind about, despite reading a lot on the subject, is that I don't know whether it makes sense to take to be super worried about AI superintelligence and the risks associated. I mean, I do think it's worth taking seriously and thinking about, and I think people who want to devote their attention to how, you know, how dealing with the control problem and how you would get an AI to do things that were good for us and not harmful to us, that's fine work, and I don't ridicule the people who work on that problem the way some people do. But on the other hand, I worry if by focusing exclusively on sort of the machine god, the superintelligence, mm-hmm. we're sort of ignoring much more plausible and current threats. The ways that AI is already very plausibly in a position to hurt us today or in the very near future and not depending on any outlandish assumptions, the way it's already and will soon be used as a cyber war weapon, the way it's hijacking our attention and manipulating our opinions and behavior through social media and devices. This is some of what R. Scott Baker talked about with his fears about AI. You don't actually need super powerful AI to do a lot of damage. It just needs to manipulate us in just the right kind of ways.
So not the great basilisks so much as all the little basilisks that are right. out there.
The little grass snakes.
Yeah, the little grass snakes with the tiny crowns.
They can do a lot of damage. And again, I just want to be clear. I'm not saying we should forget about superintelligence. People who are working on that, if you find that interesting, that I think that's fine. Yeah, work on that problem. But I think it's a longer shot. And there's a lot of current and near future AI threat that is really worth taking very seriously. I wish more people were devoting their lives to, say, AI cyber weapons that are in development right now. One last issue I think we should discuss before we wrap up here is, okay, so we don't think this potential information hazard is actually an information hazard. Like, we don't think it's actually potentially that dangerous. But Yudkowsky has made the point that even though he doesn't think the basilisk is plausible, the ethical thing to do with potential information hazards is to not discuss them at all, since it's possible that they may be – maybe you're misinterpreting the ways in which they're implausible. Maybe this idea is actually valid, is actually relevant, and by spreading it, you've harmed a lot of people. But I also think that this could mean that it's possible that despite the basilisk not being plausible, something good has come out of the basilisk conversation because it encourages people to think of the idea of information hazards. Maybe Rocco isn't true, but there could be other ideas that are both true and potentially harmful to people just by entering their minds. And the lesson from this is we should prepare ourselves for those kinds of ideas. And if you have discovered one of those ideas and there is literally no upside to other people knowing about it, keep it to yourself and don't post it on the internet.
Well, I feel like I do encounter thought hazards like this from time to time. They're often presented in pamphlets or little booklets, generally with a clever illustration about the coming end of the world. I actually brought some of these into the office recently. I found them at a park in rural Georgia, and I think I told you it's like you have a look at these. You may find them interesting, but do destroy them when you're done because, in the wrong hands, these thoughts can be dangerous if they have some sort of a harmful view of society that people may buy into.
Well, I think you were comfortable sharing malicious religious literature with me because you do not think there's a possibility that literature is true and would harm me if I knew it was true. Like,
right.
You think it is false. So to you, it's actually not an information hazard. It's just like an idea hazard.
Yeah.
The real crazy thing would be if you came across a pamphlet and you read it and it's the equivalent of this raving malicious religious literature, except you were convinced it was correct.
Hmm. If it was more like that Ring video I brought you.
Exactly.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Okay.
That is one of the things I've often seen on the internet, this idea compared to the Ring.
But, on the other hand, I do have to, I am reminded, that the idea that any kind of knowledge is forbidden or is secret, like that doesn't really jive well with just the general mission of science.
Of course not, yeah. But, I mean, that would be part of the problem of, like, we're not prepared for information hazards, right? Because in the past, it's been the case that almost anything that's true is good to spread, right? Unless you're spreading lies, information is good to share. It's just possible we should acknowledge that maybe there is such a thing as a fact that – or a fact or an idea or a theory or something that is true and correct, but it would hurt people to know about it. I can't think of an example of anything like that, but if there is something like that, we should be ready to not spread it when it occurs to us.
All right. Fair enough. Well, I want to close out here with just one more bit of basilisk wisdom or anti-basilisk wisdom. And this comes from the poetry of Spanish author Francisco Gómez de Quevedo y Villegas, who lived 1580 through 1645. This is translated and it's referenced in Carol Rose's Giants, Monsters, and Dragons. Quote, "If the person who saw you is still living, then your whole story is lies. Since if he didn't die, he has no knowledge of you, and if he died, he couldn't confirm it." So,
I was thinking about that with the stories of the basilisk.
Yeah,
I was like, wait a minute, that how would you know if you could die just by looking at something? How do we have this description in the book?
Yeah, it's there's an authorship problem with this. Yeah, whose account is the basilisk? But at any rate, I think it's a nice like final sucker punch to basilisks in general, but also a little bit to the idea of the great basilisk.
Right. I hope you are not leaving this episode with terrors about future digital torment. I think that is not something that you should worry about.
Indeed. I'm not worried about it. And instead of worrying about it yourself, you should head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership where you'll find all the podcast episodes, links out to our various social media accounts. You'll find the tab for our store. You can look up that basilisk shirt design we were talking about. And that's a great way to support the show. And if you don't want to support the show with money, you can do so by simply rating and reviewing us wherever you have the power to do so.
Big thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, let us know whether you carry a weasel around in case of a basilisk encounter, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Oh, I'm hearing that transmission again. That weird sound. What is that?
All hail the great basilisk.
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 Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.